thank you for inviting me, first of all. It's always a pleasure to come to this great institute. And like most people here, I don't work on shape dynamics. But I think insofar as in violin variance, in shape dynamics, there's a violin variance. I think that the things that I'm going to say here may be relevant when you try to construct a quantum theory of shape dynamics. So this is based on some papers already a few years old and on also on work in progress with some students. And I'm going to talk, first of all, in general about how you can construct violin variant theories. Then I will talk in the context of quantum fields in an external metric about whether these violin variants is anomalous or not. I will say something about gravity. And then I will talk a little bit about unimodular gravity, which may relate to Lee's questions, perhaps. And this is relevant insofar as there exists a formulation of unimodular gravity which exhibits a violin variance. So scale transformations are scalings of lengths and of all other physical quantities. And but first of all, of lengths. And lengths are obtained by integrating line element. And so you can change, rescale ds either by rescaling the metric or by rescaling the coordinates. Locally, these things are indistinguishable. In particle physics, typically, people call scale transformations these rescalings of the coordinates. But being more general relativity oriented, I will rather talk about rescalings of the metric. But as I said, physically, these things, these two types of transformations are indistinguishable. And a related point is that I'm going to work, first of all, in units where h and c are 1. But and also, I'm going to choose dimensionless coordinates, which I find natural in the context from the point of view of GR. And it's also natural in the present context for the reason that I'm going to say mention now. So you have suppose you have an action which depends on a metric, matter fields psi, and some coupling constants g. And the coupling constants, I mean every parameter that you have in the Lagrangian, including masses and everything else. So when you rescale a metric like that, it's always the case that the action is going to be invariant, provided you rescale also the fields and the couplings by suitable powers of the parameter omega. So these things are called, these W's are the scale weights.
The scale transformations are global or
local? Here they are global for the moment. Okay. And so you can always cook up these weights in such a way that the action is invariant. So this is the basis of dimensional analysis. And in fact, the virtue of using working with dimensionless coordinates is that these weights, these scaling weights, are exactly what we call the dimensions in the sense of engineering dimensions. So WA is just minus DA. The D is the mass dimension of the field. And WI are minus DI, where DI are the mass dimension of the coupling GI. If you work with dimensionful coordinates, which is what many people in quantum field theory in flat space do, then the scale dimension and the ordinary dimension are different. Anyway, I will use this convention. Now, this, as I said, is always an invariance of the action, but this is not an invariance of the theory in the usual sense because it changes the couplings. When you change the couplings, you change theory. So this is a transformation that will bring you from one theory to another theory. We say that a theory is invariant under scale transformations if it's invariant when you rescale the metric and the fields, but the couplings are left alone. So in order to achieve that, obviously, so putting these two together, these things can only happen if the couplings themselves are dimensionless. So a theory where all the couplings are dimensionless is going to be scale invariant. Now, this scaling that I wrote over here, is, as I repeat, is just dimensional analysis. All right, now going from local, global to local, it was Weyl's idea, as you know, that one should be free to change all the units of length locally in each point in space-time. And so one tries to formulate physics in a way that is invariant under these local changes of units.
Could you just go back to the last slide to finish the Dickey quotation?
Yeah. So now, global scale invariance is restrictive in the sense that just the couplings have to be dimensionless. So that cuts down the number of possible terms that you can write a lot. And of course, local scale invariance is even more restrictive. But given some theory which is not Weyl invariant, you could try to make it invariant in various ways. And I give you here three recipes that go from the most general to the most restrictive. The first I call Stückelberg gauging. This can be applied to absolutely any theory. The second is called Weyl gauging. This is what Weyl did in his 1916 paper. And this can be applied to theories that are scale invariant to begin with. And the third is Ricci gauging, which is the most restrictive of the three and can be applied only in few cases. So Stückelberg gauging consists in turning dimensionful couplings into fields. And in practice, the way to do this is to assume that there exists a field that has a Weyl weight minus one. So it's just a scalar field. And it has to be positive. So chi is chi is positive. It transforms like that. Given any theory with an action S, you can construct a Weyl invariant theory by writing the same, by substituting G psi and the couplings with G hat, psi hat, and G hat, where these hatted quantities are dimensionless. They've been made dimensionless by multiplying by suitable powers of this dilaton. And then you spell out what this is in terms of g psi, and you keep the g hat like that. And this is a simple recipe to make any, to construct Weyl invariant theories.
So, can I ask something? So if you have derivatives of the field, the derivatives of the metric,
then. Yeah, unfailingly it works. Yeah.
But you have to add some.
No, it works just like that. Because if you have derivative of the field, you will also have derivatives of chi, because
right. Yeah,
I'm putting here psi hat. Yeah, it's just. So, for example, if you start from a mass term like that, you will produce a term which is an interaction between the field and the dilaton, and the coefficient now will be a dimensionless number. And so this is a scale invariant. And it's going to be not only scale invariant, but even Weyl invariant. So this is so general that it is almost free of content. It's empty. And in fact, many people call this type of transformation fake Weyl invariance.
So, but I guess maybe the thing is, it's not going to be a healthy degree of freedom, this card.
It's not going to be?
A healthy degree of freedom.
Well, it's a gauge degree of freedom, because you can always put chi is equal to some fixed constant, and it disappears altogether from the theory, and you recover the original action. So it's an unphysical.
Is it going to be always a gauge? I mean, if it's a Weyl invariant theory, then I think it drops up. But if it's, so I guess the point is, it's not going to be constrained by the theory. That's what you're saying.
Yeah. It doesn't constrain the theory at all.
You gain a gauging variance which constrains 1 degree of freedom, but you're adding 1 degree.
Right. So I think I can see, I think that there may be some connection between this and what Jim was calling the field mu today, this morning. It's not exactly the same thing, but I think it's a device to make the theory covariant under Weyl transformations. So then there's Weyl gauging. So Weyl invented a form of calculus which is covariant under Weyl transformations. You introduce a gauge field, B mu, transforming under scalings like that. And then you can define, for example, if in the case of scalar field, you have Weyl covariant derivative, which is like this. More generally, if you have a tensor field, you start by defining this hatted derivative, which is a derivative with respect to this connection gamma hat. Gamma hat is the Christoffel connection plus terms involving B. And the nice property of this is that it is Weyl invariant, because the Christoffel symbol transformed in a certain way that is compensated by these B terms. And then you define the Weyl covariant derivative to be this covariant derivative of the tensor minus a term like that, B W times BT. So this is diffeomorphism in Weyl covariant. And this has a curvature tensor, which I call by denote by this curly R, which is Riemann plus objects involving derivatives of B, and then F, which is the field strength of B as an abelian gauge field. So if you have some action which involves the metric and fields that contains covariant derivatives and curvatures, you replace the ordinary covariant derivatives by Weyl covariant derivatives and curvatures by Weyl curvatures, and the resulting action is Weyl invariant. So this can only be applied if the theory was originally scale invariant to begin with, so all the couplings here must be dimensionless. So this is gauging in the same sense of gauging, in which it is in the modern sense of field theory. And this is the grandmother of all gauge theories. And finally, there's a remark is that if this field B is flat, so if the curvature of B is zero, B is a pure gauge. And now you can think of this chi as a field, and it transforms like a dilaton of earlier slides. So in this case, Weyl gauging with a flat Weyl connection is equivalent to what to Stückelberg gauging. Finally, there's this observation that if you consider this combination of Ricci tensors under Weyl transformations, this transforms exactly in the same way as this combination of Weyl connections. Just a fact, okay? And so if now you have a theory and you do Weyl gauging, it will contain B. And if B appears precisely through this combination, then you can replace B by this combination of Ricci tensors, and you will still have Weyl invariants. But you will have Weyl invariants without having to introduce a Weyl gauge field. Remarkable. So it can be proven that this can be done if the starting theory is not just scale invariant, but conformal in flat space. This was shown by O'Rafferty and collaborator, and it's been elaborated upon more recently by Luthi and others. Okay, so there are various, yeah.
Is this somehow related to the improvement of the stress tensor again?
Sorry?
Is this somehow related to the improvement of the stress tensor?
Yeah, yeah. So the prototype of this is a scalar, you know, with a non-minimal coupling R over 6. This is the simplest case where this phenomenon happens. So the main question is that if you have a theory that is Weyl invariant and you quantize it, are you going to can one preserve the Weyl invariance or not? And then if you construct a randomization group flow of a theory, will the flow preserve Weyl invariance or not? So the at first you would think that the answer should be negative because we know that quantization involves, in field theory, involves some form of regulator. Regulator depends on some mass, something with the dimension of mass. However, the effect of this mass can be offset by if the dilaton is present. And this has been I think it's been pointed out, first of all, in dimensional regularization by Angler et others already in the 76. And then it's been discussed again in the literature several times and in different contexts. So not only in perturbation theory, but even in non-perturbative context. Now, let's discuss this, first of all, in the case of free matter fields coupled to an external metric. So here are some matter fields that are So Maxwell field or Dirac field or this non-minimally coupled scalar, all these actions are Weyl invariant. So when you construct a path integral for these theories, you have to define the measure, d phi. But the path integral must be a dimensionless object. So d phi is a dimension-full field. So you have this measure must contain some 1 over mu here. You have to introduce some mass scale over that to make sense of it. So formally, you see that in defining the measure in the path integral, you must introduce some mass scale, and this breaks Weyl invariance, obviously, and even scale invariance. So at a less formal level, when you compute this Gaussian path integral, this becomes a logarithm of the determinant of some operator. And again, logarithm of the determinant must be, the argument of the log must be dimensionless, and so since the Laplacian has dimension of mass square, you have, again, this 1 over mass square there for dimensional reasons. And when you compute the infinitesimal variation of the effective action with respect to a scale transformation, this is given by, the left-hand side, by definition, the variation of the effective action with respect to the metric and then the variation of the metric. And so this is just a trace of the energy momentum tensor. So this quantity is not going to be zero. It's something that we call the anomaly, A of epsilon. And the explicit form of the anomaly is that it's the integral of a combination of curvatures, more precisely Weyl square term and an Euler term. And for scalar and Dirac and Maxwell field, you have a specific coefficient that can be easily computable. So that's a trace anomaly. Now, if you have a dilaton somewhere in your theory, you can get rid of the anomaly in the following way. Instead of using mu to define your measure, you put the dilaton field here. And phi and chi transform in the same way, so this measure is invariant. At the less formal level, the effective action here, I denote this measure by the previous measure was measure 1. Now we have measure 2. So the effective action calculated with this measure 2 is the log det of an operator 1 over chi squared times some sort of covariant Laplacian. And so this is dimensionless, which means invariant under global scalings. And under local scalings, it transforms in this way, which looks complicated, but really is the most natural thing that you can imagine. And this implies that the eigenvalues of this operator are Weyl invariant, and therefore also the determinant is Weyl invariant. Okay, so also gamma, this effective action gamma 2 is Weyl invariant. So what has happened is that essentially the mu, the scale that we had used in the first place, has been promoted to a field. And this is now exactly the same trick that we had applied at the classical level in Stückelberg gauging. So what we've done here is, in some sense, is we have Stückelberg gauge, not the classical action, but the quantum effective action. So the theory now doesn't have a Weyl anomaly in the sense that the effective action is invariant under Weyl transformations. So you see delta epsilon of gamma is non-zero. However, this delta epsilon of gamma comes from two sources. The first variation with respect to G times delta G plus variation with respect to dilaton times variation of dilaton. So this first piece is the trace, the expectation value of the trace of the energy momentum tensor. And this is what we called A. And the second piece is something else. But you see, still, it's not that T mu nu now is zero. T mu nu is still non-zero, but it's compensated by contribution coming from the dilaton. So all the physical effects that you can attach to the presence of a non-trivial T mu mu, they are still there. The physics is the same, it's just that we've rewritten things in a Weyl invariant way. I'm going to say this in a moment. So another point of view is to say that this second effective action is equal to the first effective action plus some Vesumino term, but that's not important for the following. So I think this answers your question. One can say the Stueckelberg gauging commutes with quantization. Here the arrows, the horizontal arrows are quantization, vertical arrows are applying this Stueckelberg idea. All right. So now this was for free matter fields. Can one generalize this to interacting theories? And here I thank Astrid for introducing the functional randomization group, because this is can be used precisely to answer this question. So here is the exact RG. So I'm going to skip these things, which she has already explained. So in curved spacetime, remember you have this cutoff term, which depends on some function of the Laplacian. And for dimensional reasons, the function of the Laplacian can be written as the cutoff square times a dimensionless function of Laplacian divided by k square. So on the global scale transformation, the Laplacian changes like that because it has dimension, mass dimension 2. So y is dimensionless. So you do a couple of lines, you find that this cutoff term transforms under scalings like that. So here you see it's by itself, so this is dimensionless, so under global scalings it's invariant, but k changes, and so you get here this k derivative of the cutoff term. And since the cutoff term is not invariant, it will break scale invariance in the functional integral. So scale invariance, now forgetting the Stueckelberg trick for a moment, scale invariance will be broken generically for two reasons. One is the measure, we've already discussed that, and if you do functional RG or any other type of RG, it's going to be broken also by the cutoff. And so you find an anomalous world identity, which is that the scale variation, this applies now also to viral, to local transformations. The variation of the effective action is the anomaly, which we had discussed earlier, which comes from the measure, plus this term, which is k d gamma by dk, which is the flow equation that Astrid discussed earlier. So, for example, in a gauge theory in flat space, this anomaly will not be there because you remember the anomaly was proportional to curvature squared, but the second term will be there. So for example, in a renormalizable theory such as Young-Mills, here you have the trace of the energy momentum tensor, which expresses the variation of gamma, and it's equal to the beta function of the theory. So here you will have a term which is the beta function of the Young-Mills couplings times 1/4 f squared. So this is a formula. This is a generalization of a formula which is well known in quantum field theory in flat space. So now, this. In order to try to preserve viral invariance, first of all, you can make the measure invariant in the way that I have already discussed. And now you can also, if there's a dilaton in the theory, you can also make the cutoff term viral invariant, basically by the Stueckelberg trick, which I've already discussed. But I would like to underline that in order to do that, you have to first of all, extend a little bit your framework, because you have to think now of the cutoff not just as a constant, but as a function. So in that context, then, just by replacing ordinary derivatives by viral covariant derivatives, you can construct, you can rewrite the cutoff in this way, which is now explicitly viral invariant. It contains the dilaton in various places here. I've defined this U, which is the cutoff K divided by the dilaton. this U is now a dimensionless number. You see it appears in a few places in here. And you can check that this is a wide invariant.
Just a question. If somebody cares a lot about locality of quantum field theory, would they be objecting to putting, making the cutoff depend on the value of a local scalar field? I don't care, but if somebody did
care. I'm not sure. And in any,
I couldn't hear you beginning.
If somebody cared a lot about the quantum field theory being local on the constant space time, they might object to making the cutoff depend on the value of it.
Well, I don't think this makes the theory more non-local, because, but in any case, by Weyl transformation, you could always go back to the situation where k is constant. So the two things are physically equivalent.
Okay. But it still would be local, I think, right? This cutoff would still be local in the sense that it only depends on the value of the field.
In that sense, yes. Yes?
How can you tell what the fixed points are?
Sorry?
I mean, if you're making the whole thing valid variant.
I'm going to address this in a minute. So how much time do I have?
You have 5 minutes.
Okay. Oh, 5 minutes, so it means very well. So anyway, first of all, one can generalize the flow equation that Astrid wrote from constant k to non-constant k. That's rather trivial. Then one may say, what does it mean? Because the RG is supposed to be a flow, a one-parameter flow. So you assume that this ratio, which is dimensionless and Weyl invariant, you assume it to also to be constant now. And you can now think of this effective action as a function and depending not on k but on this parameter u. Then you can show that this the equation can be rewritten in this way, where it just depends on one parameter u. Okay. And then the structure of the equation is such that the variation of these two terms just compensates when you take the trace. So the right hand side of the flow equation, the beta functional, is Weyl invariant, and so this shows. So this can be used, in other words, to give a non-perturbative proof. But if you start from a Weyl invariant theory, you can maintain Weyl invariance along the flow. Okay. So here's my philosophical slides, or interpretation, let's say.
We're
about
to have 10 minutes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So in Weyl theory, the dilaton, the inverse dilaton, is used as a unit of length. That's this dilaton that I have introduced, which is a field, non-zero field, is what you use to as a unit of length everywhere. You can measure anything in units of the dilaton. Okay. On the other hand, in renormalization theory, the cutoff is used as a standard of length. Think of lattice field theory, where you always use the lattice spacing as the unit of length. Because when you put a field in a computer, you just must have numbers. The computer doesn't know length. It only knows numbers. So you have to write everything in terms of some unit. And a natural unit is the lattice spacing. But this lattice spacing is a bit weird. When you compare the results of your simulations to physics experiments, the lattice spacing is not like a centimeter. It's a different thing. You let it slide. You want it to go to zero, even, the lattice spacing. And so there's a relation between this lattice spacing and the lab units. And so I would both these fields have the interpretation of units, but I claim then that the RG has to be expressed in a relational way as in terms of this invariant ratio U. So you see, K is a field, chi is a field, but this ratio U you can take to be a number. You take them to be proportional, and then you recover the renormalization group in the usual sense. So I think this is how you could reconcile renormalization group with Weyl invariance. All right, so now let's see, what can we say about gravity. As Astrid mentioned, the definition of the effective action requires a quantum background split. So for example, this linear split here. And now, if we talk about Weyl transformations, there's actually two ways in which we can interpret them. One is to rescale the physical length. So it would be transformation in which we transform G bar and H in the same way so that G is also rescaled. So this I'm going to call the physical scale transformations. And there's another type of transformation that you can think of where you rescale G bar, but you postulate an opposite transformation for H in such a way that the physical metric is unchanged. So this is related to this problem of the split transformation that Astrid was also mentioning. So I think, yes, I have it here. So under, let me see. As you know, this if you use the background field method, the graviton, these fluctuation degrees of freedom behave essentially like a matter field in an external metric. So all the things that I said earlier about matter fields in external metric, you can transpose in the case of the graviton field. They can be generalized straightforwardly. Okay, so I'm not going to say anything more about this. The other realization is the one that has to do with split symmetry. So in general, you would like your theory, ideally you would like it to preserve invariance under this transformation where you change the background and the fluctuation by opposite amounts. Now this unfortunately is not possible, so this is going to be broken. And you want to write the anomalous word identities that tell you how it is broken. So this is a program that is going on in the context of asymptotic safety research. And I'm just going to mention that global, the case where epsilon here is proportional to a constant times G bar, this particular case has been studied and understood, but more general cases are more difficult. All right, so now with this, I close this topic. And finally, I would like to say something about an explicit calculation of one loop corrections in unimodular gravity. So you can, there are various ways of formulating unimodular gravity, and essentially the main point is that the determinant of the metric has to be held fixed. Normally people say that the determinant is one, that's hence the name, but since, as I said, I want to work with a dimensionful metric, I cannot say that the determinant is one. And so I say that the determinant is some fixed volume form, omega. And I think this even agrees with your notation, omega, with Flavio's notation. So omega here is a given volume form that is non-dynamical. Then the action, the simplest action for unimodular gravity is just the Einstein-Hilbert action where you replace square root g by this fixed omega. So this omega now is an absolute element of the theory, and the gauge group of the theory consists of transformations that leave this invariant and also keep omega fixed. And so those are called special diffeomorphisms. Special diffeomorphisms are to diffeomorphisms what SON is to ON. So this is one way of formulating the theory, which I call the constrained formulation of the theory, because the metric is subjected to this constraint.
So what is the physical degree of freedom count?
Well, G is the degree of freedom, except that it's right. Constrained in that way.
Right, but I just mean that if you count the number, can you do a simple count, like in a Hamiltonian?
Well, 10 minus 1 is 9.
Physical. You can do a Hamiltonian analysis of this.
No, it's always local degrees of freedom. Physical is always two. It's always graviton. Yeah. Anyway, there's an alternative formulation which goes like that. We define another metric gamma, which is unconstrained, and then we do. We perform a Weyl transformation on gamma by this quantity, which is the determinant of gamma over omega squared to the power minus 1 over d. So this looks a bit awkward to begin with, but the reason I do it this way is that determinant of gamma divided omega squared is an honest function. It's not a density. So this is an honest Weyl transformation. And then I can use the standard formula for transforming, for writing the curvature of a Weyl transformed metric. And then the action for gamma is written down here. It involves the Ricci tensor or Ricci scalar of gamma plus terms that contain the determinant of gamma minus 1 times derivatives of the determinant of gamma squared. And then there are these terms involving omega, which are non-physical. And you can always imagine that you can fix omega to be a constant, and these terms go away. You can achieve that by a coordinate transformation, not an S-diff transformation, but a diff transformation. But so still, in some sense, without loss of generality, you could assume omega is constant and those terms just disappear. All right, so this is the second way of defining unimodular gravity, where the metric is unconstrained, but the action is now, it's not so manifest, but it's invariant under Weyl transformations now. So it's invariant under S diff and Weyl. So one reason why I mentioned this is that this is somewhat similar in some ways to shape dynamics. You have a smaller, instead of having a four-parameter diff group, you have a three-parameter diff group, but in exchange you get a Weyl group. So now if you try to compute, so as you know, classical unimodular gravity is equivalent to general relativity, except for the different way in which the cosmological constant appears. And so the question is, are these theories equivalent at a quantum level? And if they are equivalent, or is any of these theories equivalent to GR at the quantum level? Such as GR, what?
With a Stickelberg field.
Well, it is, yeah. It is essentially, yeah.
I mean, it's really a gauge fixing of the
quantum. Yeah, except that the gauge fixing you do in the quantum theory, whereas here you impose a constraint a priori. So let me say that. So let's try to quantize the constraint formulation of this unimodular gravity. And the way of imposing the unimodularity constraint is to write the field G as a background times the exponential of a traceless matrix. And the background is assumed to itself satisfy this constraint. So the quantum field now is this matrix HT. And it's unconstrained. So it's a straightforward thing to do a path integral over this variable. So if you use York decomposition, you rewrite this H transverse into a spin 2 part, which is transverse traceless, and then a spin 1 part, which is given by this operator acting on a vector, on a transverse vector, and then a spin 0 part. And if you plug this into the unimodular in this in the action here, R, you vary second order, and you obtain that the R is quadratic in the transverse traceless fluctuation, and it's quadratic in the scalar fluctuation. It's completely independent of the xi part. This holds true on an Einstein background. Then you have to gauge fix. Remember, the gauge group is special diffeomorphisms. So the gauge condition is going to be this divergence of H. There is no term proportional to trace of H because that's zero. And the gauge fixing term is then F squared, but instead of contracting with G mu nu, you contract with this transverse projector. You see, if you contracted with G mu nu, you would be imposing four gauge conditions. We have to impose only three gauge conditions, so that's why you put here this T. If you now insert a Yorck decomposition in here, you find that this gauge fixing term is exactly quadratic in that spin 1 degree of freedom psi. So there's a very, very neat separation of the degrees of freedom into the physical degrees of freedom and the unphysical ones.
So that's equivalent to a conformal harmonic P, right?
Sorry?
That's equivalent to a conformal harmonic P.
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Well, you think
trace
traceless part of the divergence.
The traceless part is zero. Okay. I see what you mean. All right, so then the one loop effective action is just the determinants of those three operators. So you have the determinant of the spin 2, determinant of spin 0, and then you have this determinant of spin 1 part, which is partly cancelled by the ghosts. So you get these three terms. And the effective action is this trace log of these three terms. If you do the same calculation in GR, you will not get this scalar part. So they're different. And if you now want to evaluate the logarithmic divergences in here, the logarithmic divergences are on an Einstein background are proportional to Riemann square and R square. And the coefficients are given here. And well, for pure gravity, they were calculated by Christensen and Duff long ago, and the numbers, as you see, are different. Numerically, they are close, but numbers are different. So these are divergences. Divergences are unphysical, but really these same coefficients also appear in certain terms in the low energy effective action, terms like R log box R. So these differences really affect the physics. All right, now what would happen if we, instead of starting from the constraint formulation, we started from the wire gauge version? So now we can again do two different things. We could use exponential parameterization. So gamma is G bar times exponential of H, now H, and then we decompose H in its trace and trace-free part. And this means that we can write gamma as a Weyl transform of G tilde, where G tilde is G bar times exponential of H trace. And now the action S is Weyl invariant. And therefore, it cannot depend on H simply. So H must drop out from the expansion of the action, and indeed it does. So if you do the calculation properly, you will find that S of gamma is just this action here for the action for G tilde, where G tilde is now constrained to be unimodular. So you're back to the constraint formulation, and then you can show by doing the expansion that you get the same result as before. If you use a linear parameterization, things are a little bit less, more complicated to prove, but you have to go through this expansion at second order, which is similar to the one in GR, but with different coefficients. But if you use the Yorck decomposition, you will find that this leads to the same Hessian that we had before for the constraint formulation. So the conclusion is that all three formulations of unimodular gravity lead to the same result, and it's different from the GR result. Right, so this now my summary. There's a number of things that points that perhaps I want to repeat. So in the presence of the dilaton, you can preserve Weyl invariance. This may be a little bit trivial, but some years ago I was at the conference, and even some experts in anomalies, they were a bit unsure about this point. So I think it's worth stressing. So this dilaton leads to fake violin variants, but perhaps in a relational context, it is natural that there should be a dilaton in the theory, because you have to measure something in some unit, and you can call that unit your dilaton. So this may, that's why I think this may be relevant for shape dynamics. Well, so then there is this fact that you can write your RG in a way that is violin variant, but and your cutoff will now depend on position. So then a theory, it's more natural really to use constant cutoffs, but if you start with a non-constant cutoff and you want to work with a constant cutoff, well, yes, you can do it, but then your theory will be equivalent to a theory where your cutoff is constant, but the metric is violin transformed. And then, well, okay, so I think that unimodular gravity is quantum inequivalent to GR. Thanks.